Hobbies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. 087 1400 106 is our WhatsApp number, and our email address is afternoon@newstalk.com. It is time to round off the week with Movies and Booze. We're joined in the studio by Shannon Keenan, Chris Wasser and Michelle Lawler. Good afternoon to you all.
Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon.
We're doing baby wines. Yeah. That sounds kind of wrong, but...
Yeah. Even when I describe it, it sounds even worse, actually. Yeah. So wine for babies? No. So basically what it is like... Not baby, but like junior versions of flagship wines. So we've not got a Chablis, but a Petit Chablis.
Yeah.
And we don't have a Barolo, we have a Lange Nebbiolo. And just a few other examples of, you know, if you might fancy trying like the big icon premium wines, how do you taste them without the premium icon price?
Yeah.
So we have a Petit Chablis, Lange Nebbiolo. And not wine for babies, but baby wine.
Yeah. But does that mean essentially that, you know, the expensive one is made in position X and this one is just slightly down the hill kind of thing?
So you are right and wrong. The Chablis, that's exactly for number one, wrong for number two. So the Petit Chablis is exactly that. A premium Chablis is in the centre of the slope. And then Petit Chablis is the top and the bottom for a few reasons. And then the Lange Nebbiolo, what you find, it's a bit like second wines in Bordeaux. The Lange Nebbiolo is, say there might be some younger vines or maybe some might be mixed in. Some of the berries mightn't have been good enough to go into the Barolo, but too good to sell off for... The others, I was going to say S-H-I-T-E, don't know if I'm allowed. I won't.
And, Mammy, what does that spell?
So they're kind of like, they want to keep it because it's good enough to put their own name on it, but not good enough to put the top name on it. So there's a mixture.
Yeah.
And it happens a lot. So we have, and I have a couple of other examples because it's a great way, because you think, oh, I want to know, do I like Barolo? Well, I like that grape because it can be kind of Marmite-y. So it's a great way to try some of those premium things without spending $50.
Yeah. Perus. Okay, great. I'm all for that. The two movies, well, I suppose what unites them is the weird way.
Yeah.
Because like when I saw And Sons, and that's ampersand Sons, I thought maybe like
I'd forgotten to put the title.
Yeah, you put the first word in. Watt and Sons, but it's just And Sons.
Yeah. It's supposed to be Dyer and Sons. It's a British drama with a sci-fi twist, which we'll get into. With Bill Nighy, it's about an internationally renowned author.
But it's not called Dyer and Sons.
No.
It's called And Sons. But why did they do that? Because that's kind of confusing to
people.
It is
confusing, yeah. It doesn't look great in print. It doesn't look great in my notes, clearly. But that is the name of it. It's based on a David Gilbert novel. And they might get away with that sort of title on the stage, but on a film screen, it does look a little bit weird. But it is a little bit weird itself. It's about an author who is, you know, the creative well is dried up. He hasn't written anything. He hasn't left the house in 20 years. He, you know, destroyed his family. And in this film, he thinks he's about to die. So he gathers up his family for what is a very awkward reunion.
Yeah.
And then the other one is completely...
All exclamation.
That train. You have to say it like that as well. So Stop That Train is... it's in the RuPaul's Drag Race universe, basically. And it's RuPaul Charles producing and starring in a film about a couple of train stewardesses who have to prevent America's first bullet train from colliding with a nuclear power plant and blowing up America.
Yeah. Is this like Airplane.
Airplane. It's totally, it's like, this is the type of thing that your man Hayes used to make, that Leslie Nielsen. It's exactly like that. And having watched it, we'll get into it a little bit later, I can say that we actually need more of that, I think.
Okay, well, I probably Airplane's Marmite-y, but I think that's a very high bar compared to Airplane.
If anybody texts in and says they do not like Airplane, I will never do this segment again.
Oh, no. somebody no doubt will. But okay, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm both of these are in cinemas
from today. Yeah.
From today. Okay, good stuff. I suppose to start, Shannon, on a kind of a bit of a downbeat today would have been Hayden Panettiere's 37th birthday.
I know. It's actually such heartbreaking news. So the beloved actress who was known for her roles in Heroes, Bring It On, Nashville and Scream sadly died on the 16th of August at the age of 36 from a suspected overdose at a residence in South Carolina. And today, she would have been 37. So it's absolutely heartbreaking. Her work and her legacy continue to be celebrated by fans and colleagues around the world, with the likes of Hilary Duff, Frankie Muniz and David Arquette paying tribute to her. And during her final interview as well, back in May, So recently, with Jay Shetty to promote her book, This Is Me, A Reckoning, she spoke about growing up as a child star, her struggles with addiction, and opened up about her experience with postpartum depression. So she really went through a lot. But in that interview, she was so positive about the future, which makes it even more heartbreaking today.
Yeah. How is her career going? Was she slated to be in anything?
I don't know. I can't really remember. She was in the Scream movies for
Them. And Bring It On, All or Nothing. She was in Ice Princess as well. So Bring It On, All or Nothing, that's what I grew up on. And then Ice Princess as well, where she's like a figure skater. So, oh, it's actually just, it's really sad.
Yeah, it's very sad.
That first season of Heroes was terrific.
Yeah.
She was in that from the very beginning and everyone in that was great.
Yeah. God, it is sad. Yeah. Right, so the MTV VMAs, they've announced the nominations. Is that still a thing?
Yes, it is.
It sounds like we're in the 80s all of a sudden.
Well, it started off in the 80s in 1984. So if you didn't know, the award show is an annual affair presented by MTV to honour the very best in music video medium, and features performances and awards for various categories like Song and Artist of the Year. And this year, Madonna leads the nominations with 11 nods, followed by Taylor Swift with 9, and Ariana Grande and Sabrina Carpenter both have 7. And in true Taylor Swift fashion, she could make history on the night, because if she wins just one of her 11 nominations, she will officially be the most awarded VMA artist ever, which is so cool. I feel like they should just rename the Guinness World Book of Records after her, because she has broken so many records now at this stage. The nominees for Artist of the Year is Ariana Grande, Bruno Mars, Madonna, Morgan Wallen, Sabrina Carpenter and Taylor Swift. And then the nominees for Video of the Year, which is the big one of the night, is Hate That I Made You Love Me by Ariana Grande, I Just Might by Bruno Mars, Storm by The Purple, Confessions 2 Film by Madonna, Tears by Sabrina Carpenter, and The Faith of Ophelia by Taylor Swift. Plus, on the night, there's also the Michael Jackson Award, which is a Lifetime Achievement Award. And we don't
Suddenly everyone's
really comfortable with that one, Shannon. Yeah, great. Everybody wants to win the Michael Jackson Award.
Oh, I love it. I wonder who came up with that one.
I know. Well, they might rename it. I don't know. But that's
Bankrupt Award goes to.
That's what it's called right now. Now, we don't know who is up for that, but the rumours are Miley Cyrus, Bruno Mars, Christina Aguilera, which I think would be a really good one. And then, of course,
Taylor Swift.
There we go.
I'm sure she'll want to win that one.
But the awards are for videos.
Yes, yeah. Video, like music.
So has Madonna made 11 videos that she could have 11 nominations?
No, so it'll
Or is it like best shoes in a video?
There'll be 11 different categories.
Yeah.
So like song, music video, like direction, visuals, graphics, like there's loads of different categories.
So you're basically getting 11 nominations for the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's all to do with the one video.
And it's funny Opalite didn't get into that, because that was like the best video.
Yeah.
Taylor
Swift. Pretty good.
That was easily the best.
So your money's on her then?
No, because it's a different song. Fate of Ophelia.
Oh, yeah.
I think Opalite's the one with all the people from the Graham Norton show.
That's Opalite.
And then they're
at the
wedding.
That the VMAs are always awarded to the artist instead of the director. So I actually hope Taylor gets it, because she directs her own videos. So she should get the award.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
That was the big problem. You'd always have the likes of, you know, Beyonce or Madonna, whoever it was, accepting these awards. It's like, you didn't do anything. You just stood there in front of the camera. Like, the directors and the editors and the visual effects people, they should be getting the awards.
Yeah. Do they, are they even invited along?
Probably not.
They're probably watching it in a hotel nearby if they're lucky.
They are, yeah.
Oh, would they not all be all on the same table, maybe?
I don't know.
And then when she goes,
you tell us. Yeah.
I would imagine they're all sitting on the same table. And then when she goes up to get the award, then she's like, I'd like to say thank you to the director and
who did all the hard work.
Yeah. You can watch it live on Paramount Plus on Sunday, the 27th of September.
That's like saying I get in the Pulitzer and say, I'd like to thank the guy who wrote the book for me. That's so odd. Right, okay. So tell us about our first wine.
First wine. So it's the one that's white in your glass. It's right. The Chablis.
Good guide.
So, yes. So Chablis, for anyone who doesn't know, is actually a place. And if you want to call your wine Chablis, you have to grow your grapes within the Chablis area. Mm. And it is always 100% Chardonnay. There's something really cool about Chablis, and it's where the root of the Petit Chablis story comes from, is that Chablis soil is called Kimmeridgian, and it's the same soil in Sancerre. However, Chablis is Chardonnay and Sancerre is Sauvignon Blanc. And there's always this thing, you know, the ABS, anything but Sauvignon, ABC, anything but Chardonnay. But there's a lot of similarities in just those two main French icons of Sancerre and Chablis. So in 1938, they created the Chablis area. The best vineyards, creating the best expression of Chablis, of Chardonnay. But then there was people slightly outside of that area who, for all intents and purposes, were in Chablis, but they weren't on the Kimmeridgian soils. And so they were like, well, hold on, please, can we be, because obviously you're going to get more money if your wine is called Chablis as opposed to Van de Pay, you know, something or other. So basically those wine growers petitioned to get their area. And so Chablis, if you think of a slope, is in the centre of the slope, and the tops and the bottoms of the Chablis area are a different soil. Can I remember it? Portlandian. There you go.
Hey, geology well lesson.
I fished that out of my brain. And so basically, Petit Chablis effectively is wines from the top of the slope and the bottom of the slope. So arguably, is it less good? The big difference between Petit Chablis, and if you think of a pyramid, the bottom of the pyramid is Petit Chablis. Then you go higher up the pyramid. So then you've got Chablis. Hmm. Then you've got Premier Cru Chablis. And then you've got Grand Cru Chablis. The big difference between the Petit Chablis is that this is made to be drunk immediately. And it is generally more affordable, more accessible. Did you like it?
Yeah, I thought it was lovely.
Chablis, what a winner. Yeah. That wins every time, doesn't it?
So I assume it's kind of generally speaking hotter with a Petit Chablis.
Not necessarily, but hotter and then colder, because it's the bottom of the slope and the top of the slope, and they don't differentiate.
How do they draw a line between this is good, not
so
good?
Soil. Yeah. It's literally the soil difference. Okay. And so the Kimmeridgian soil is, do you remember in way back when in your geography books, and there would be pictures of soil and there'd be like maybe little fossils and shells and things. Hmm. That's what that Kimmeridgian soil is. But what it creates is a wine with much more minerality, tension, and then something with much bigger aging potential. Whereas Petit Chablis, it's made to be drunk young, while still having all those key benchmarks and things that you love about a Chablis, without the price tag and without the huge aging potential. Because Chablis and Petit Chablis are typically made in stainless steel. It's all about the freshness, the zinginess, because that's lemony and it's quite dry and it's quite, I would say, textural. It feels really kind of velvety in the mouth. When you go into Premier Cru and Grand Cru, you go into the thing that all the Sauvignon Blanc drinkers hate, which is oak. Premier Cru will have a bit of oak. Grand Cru will have loads of oak, because Grand Cru is made to live for 20 years as opposed to 1, 2 or 3 years, which is what the Petit Chablis is. And this one that we have here, Gérard Tremblay, I think possibly the best value Chablis producer in Ireland for so many reasons. But what they do really well, because they also produce, they have Grand Cru vineyards, Premier Cru vineyards, regular Chablis and the Petit Chablis. They know how to make the amazing wines that are going to last 20 years. So you get all that skill, but in this wine. So you're tasting something of very high quality. But a lot of the wines from Gérard Tremblay are in a lot of the Michelin star restaurants around the country.
Okay.
So they're really, really high. And they're fifth generation winemakers. And I just think it's a really cool concept, because a lot of times wine labels are jargon that you don't know what they mean. Most of the time you're a bit too embarrassed to ask, or you think you know loads and you tell the wine expert what you know, which happens quite a lot. And there's a couple of other examples actually of that thing where there's the original area like Chablis, and then people in the greater area thought, oh look, we're very close, why can't we also get that? So do you ever see on an Italian wine label Chianti Classico or Valpolicella Classico? Classico refers to the original historic region that was deemed, okay, this is Chianti. But then wine growers who were like, you know, a little bit out further in the fields were like, well, hold on a second. We're really close. We grow the same grape. The climate's the same. Everything's the same. Why can't I also be called Chianti? Because you get more money if you've got that designation. So they lobbied to basically also become Chianti. So what happened was they changed
The original Chianti became Chianti Classico, and then the greater area for the other wine growers who labored it became regular Chianti, and the same at Valpolicella. So Classico is the original, historic. Is it any better? Look, you could find some amazing people slightly outside, and their wine might be more expensive than the Classico. And then you might find some people who mightn't, you know, make great wine, but they're in the Classico area. So there they are, and they get the extra couple of yo-yos for their wine.
It's like kind of like, you know, you can, you live in kind of Ratmines West, but it's not really Ratmines at all. You know, it's just for the house prices or the wine poshness.
It's very much like that. And I admire that the grape growers lobby to say, hold on a second here, we're growing the same grape, we're in the same area. Yeah, we've got a little bit of a different, you know, we might not have as many seashells in our soil. Please, can we have it? But I think it's a good thing, because actually what it does do is it's a bit like, say, Rathmines, right? All the houses, there's no more building to be done.
Yeah.
At maximum capacity. So what do you do? And what happens is if it's at maximum capacity, all the prices go up. So all of a sudden you're paying twice the price for your Chablis or your four bed semi-D. So if you can able to widen the area, then you get more of that thing without adding to the price
point. Or at least that's the argument they're using. So Chris, what movie would you like to do
Stop
first?
That Train.
Stop That Train, coming up after this.
Welcome aboard.
Before we depart, I'll turn it over to your lovely rail attendants for your safety presentation.
Ladies and gentlemen, can you please direct your attention to the front of the cabin? Dee Dee, what's going on?
And a 5, 6, 7, 8.
I think we're being hijacked.
Pay attention. Shut up. Some instructions to keep you tightened up.
The duration of the ride, stay inside and remain in your seat.
Apparently Ryanair are going to start doing that. That's Stop That Train. Yep. It's in cinemas now.
It is.
So, I love it already. I love it. I really do genuinely love it. So, because I remember there was an old American show called Super Train.
Yeah.
Which not was that. Like, which it's not that. No, but maybe they were inspired partially by that, because in the same way that Airplane was inspired by all the airport disaster movies.
Absolutely.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to see more spoof films. Stop That Lewis. Yeah. Stop That Boat.
Well, that's all too easy. Really,
yeah,
isn't
it? Really is. Yeah, film will be over in 30 seconds. No, I had a good time with this. We'll get the bad stuff out of the way, which is that the director, Adam Shankman, has been doing interviews throughout the summer, because this was actually released in US cinemas a little bit earlier. And he defended the film on Instagram, saying, you know, people have been saying that generative AI was used for some of the visual effects. It wasn't. This film, you know, 100% human made, and we employed hundreds of visual effects artists to, you know, get it over the line. He went back on himself then when he was talking to Extra Magazine, and he did say that for a handful of shots, AI was used to assist or to finish the shots. I don't
now,
know.
Why does that keep happening? The directors keep saying, nope, no, nothing to see here. And then a few weeks later, is it they didn't know at the time? And
I
then somebody goes, hang on.
It might be that. It might be that, actually, because, you know, they're essentially, you know, some directors are essentially glorified floor managers. And when the film actually goes into, you know, post-production, they might not be there for all of it, or other producers will come in and take over. But he said that none of the shots were conceived by AI. But what you get then is AI was used to finish them off. Mm. Now, I was wondering whether or not you need to be, you know, an expert. We were talking before about this, whether or not you need to be an expert in these things to cop that AI was used. I don't think you need to. I think when you see an AI effect in a film, it's very obvious. It's sloppy. It doesn't look great. There's no charm to it whatsoever. And I think that is a shame, because the thing with Airplane and any other spoof film, you know, the Naked Gun films, anything Leslie Nielsen did in the 80s and 90s, part of the charm was the janky visual effects.
Yeah.
The fact that it looked like it was all held together by sticky, you know, sticky tape and blue tack.
You can almost see a hand holding the plane.
Yeah. This thing could collapse in on itself at any moment. And that was part of the appeal. So what I will say is, if this film, it hasn't gone down well in America, but it's only opening internationally now. So if it does go on to be a success commercially, and if there is room there to build a franchise around it, ditch the AI. You don't need it. It doesn't have to look perfect. We don't
why
have to.
Why hasn't it gone down well in the States?
I don't know. Is the short answer. I don't know whether it was the fact that they hadn't got a huge marketing budget. They definitely didn't have a huge production budget. I don't know whether the word just wasn't out there that this film was released in cinemas. It probably just got, you know, eaten alive by The Odyssey and by Brand New Day, Spider-Man Brand New Day. I mean, those two films have taken in $3 billion in one summer. There's no room for anyone else at the box office. But story-wise, it's a bit of fun. It's about two train stewardesses. Their names are Tess and Dee Dee. They've always dreamed of serving the handsome and the elite on a service like the Glamazonian Express, which is America's first ever bullet train service. Yeah. Unfortunately, these two characters, they actually work for Stank Rail, which is as nasty as it sounds. Yeah. And through a series of coincidences, they end up getting, you know, exactly what they dreamed of. They're on their first ever Glamazonian Express journey. They come up against their old bullies at the Train Stewardess Academy. There is such a place. Mm-hmm. And their day goes from, you know, problematic to worse when they realize that the brakes have stopped working, that they're heading towards something called a Stormaganza. Which is an apocalyptic storm, basically.
Yeah, they're the worst.
Yeah? And that they're also, if the brakes don't start working again, they will crash into a spot that's midway between a nuclear power plant in Florida and Laurie Metcalf's house.
Yeah.
So, and there's also, I think there's like a Make-A-Wish trip as well in the middle of the tracks, of course there is. So these two girls, Tess and Dee Dee, they have to basically save the day. And the only way they can do that is if they get the attention of the US President, Judy Gagwell, played by RuPaul Charles. And it's up to Judy Gagwell, Tess and Dee Dee, and all of, you know, other characters that you'll recognize from the RuPaul Drag Race world, like Marsha, Simone, Brooklyn Hates, to basically stop this train.
Yeah.
Yeah, the clue's in the title. Yeah. I had a lot of fun with this. How often do I sit here and complain about films taking themselves too seriously? You want spoof films to take themselves seriously. You want them to be 100% committed to the bit.
Yes.
So I love the fact that everyone in this film, from the leads I just mentioned to Sarah Michelle Gellar to Rachel Bloom to Jesse Tyler Ferguson, the cameos in this thing are very, very good. Joel McHale's in there as well. They are all, it's so deadpan and it's so serious, and they're committed to the calamity. They're committed to the catastrophe. But I love the fact that they're playing it so straight, and then in the next scene you might have a cutaway to like a railway map done in crayon.
Yeah.
Or, you know, someone reading, you know, a conductor porn magazine. Something like that. I quite like that. I like the puns. I love the fact that, you know, it's just the things in this film, they don't make sense. They don't have to. At one point, the train driver gets, you know, attacked by a scorpion. Where did the scorpion come from? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The comic timing is brilliant. It is very well done. It's such a shame that they felt the need to polish it up with those hideous AI effects.
Can you see them? Did you notice them when you saw them?
Yeah, okay. There's a clip where Judy Gagwell. There's a clip where Judy Gagwell comes in to save the day and she swings into action. And you're like, well, that wasn't CGI. That wasn't real. That was definitely AI. Some of the backdrops are AI too. It's a pity that they did have to do that because, again, part of the appeal is supposed to be scrappy. It's supposed to be kind of cheap. But I had a good time with this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you know, the leads are quite charming. The supporting players are, as I say, are completely committed. There's room if you wanted to build a franchise. If you are going to do that, just don't. I know I keep saying it, but don't use the AI. I will fully support it.
But would the AI put you off, though, really? On balance of everything you've described, though?
It's just the fact that might have taken a job from somebody.
It
looks bad. It might have taken a job from somebody. And let's face it, the filmmakers can talk about how they were in a rush to get this thing over the line. Who was rushing you? Take another month or two if you need it to finish this film. It will all be worth it in the end. No, I had a good time with this.
Yeah. And is it like the airplane movies in that it's gag, 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 gag? It was almost like the Leslie Nielsen movies had a quota. They had to, one gag a minute.
It's one gag a minute, and the gags are mostly fresh, but there are recurring bits as well. One of my favourites was that, back in the, there's a building where, you know, people are keeping an eye on the Glamazonian Express, and they're the guys that teach us all about Stormagansas and all the rest of the train experts, basically, led by Rachel Bloom from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And she has this recurring bit where she has to deliver really, you know, shocking news to her boss. And every time she does that, she's told to give it to me straight, and she'll deliver the news. And then she's like, give it to me gay. It's fantastic. I would love if that actually became a thing in comedy films now. So yeah, the comedy is quite sharp. It's the sight gags. It's a film that actually deserves a rewatch because there are so many sight gags in there that you I've missed maybe half a dozen in the last minute.
Yeah.
So even if this film doesn't make, you know, $100 million at the box office, I can see it picking up a cult following. Mm. Some, you know, midnight screenings here and there. Mm. People might say, there's songs in it too. I mean, what does this film not have? Yeah, I think it will find an audience. It might be a small one, but it will find one.
Yeah, and the great thing about the Relentless, even if one is terrible, you're kind of laughing because the last one was good. You know, and you're on to the next one.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds fantastic. Great to hear that.
Yeah. Sounds amazing.
Is it a case that all Chablis is Chardonnay, but not all Chardonnay is Chablis?
That is correct.
Yes. Ding ding.
Ding ding.
Yeah.
So, because you can make if you are making wine in the Chablis area and you want to call it Chablis, it has to be legally 100% Chardonnay.
Yeah.
However, you can grow Chardonnay. I like totally drew a blank there. Where else can you grow Chablis? Say just Australia and New Zealand, but you can't call that Chablis because to call your wine Chablis, it has to be in this area in France.
Mm.
So you could grow, you could produce in Australia Chablis made to, for all intents and purposes, look and taste like a Chablis, but because it's not produced in the Chablis area, you can just call it Chardonnay or maybe Chardonnay.
Yeah.
Or so like New Zealand or other parts of France and the rest of the world. But if you've, all Chablis is always Chardonnay, but not all Chablis. Chardonnay is always Chablis.
Okay. Good explanation. David in Galway says, Airplane had no comedic actors. They all play the scene straight. That's why it worked. Nobody laughed in any scene. No, that's true. And like Leslie Nielsen just went straight from doing the kinds of films he was, and then went into films taking the piss out of himself without having, you know, missing a beat kind of thing.
I love
it was amazing.
If you had a Leslie Nielsen season or something like Vallejo Cinema, you'd be alarmed by the first half of the season. You'd be like, these are all serious dramas.
I know, But you might find them funny.
And then, you know, paired with like Dracula dead and loving it or something. He was a serious actor at one stage.
No, he was. But was he in anything good? You know what he was in? He was in Forbidden Planet.
Okay.
Which is a classic sci-fi, which is a kind of a sci-fi version of a Shakespeare play.
Yeah, yeah. That's the 1960s,
The Tempest, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing. I'd love to have been in the room when Leslie Nielsen and when someone came in and said, listen, these are the types of films we think you should now make, Airplane and Naked Gun. Yeah, it was a different career.
Yeah. Right, so there's going to be this live-action version of Tangled about which no one's that excited, but Katrina Balfe's going to be in it.
I'm excited. I'm really excited for her. And it's because Katrina Balfe is in it because she's a Dublin native and we love that. She starred in Outlander and Now You See Me, and she will be taking on the role of Queen Ariana, the mother of the lost princess Rapunzel. And taken to Instagram to share the news, she has described the upcoming project as truly magical. She will be joining Tegan Croft, who is playing Princess Rapunzel, and then Milo Mannheim, which is playing her love interest Flynn Rider, and then Catherine Hine is also playing Mother Goddell. So she is responsible of locking Rapunzel away in the tower, and I'm literally buzzing to see what she does with that character, because as we know, if we've seen the animated version of Tangled, there's singing, it's fabulous, she's so evil and creepy, but she's supposed to like be playing a nice girl to Rapunzel, but we all know she's evil. So I'm really excited to see what she does with that. The film is going to drop to cinemas the 31st of March 2028.
Yeah. Those things.
I'm super excited.
I know, but I mean, like, you've had a perfectly, almost perfect iteration of this story.
Yeah.
What can a live action version add to that?
Other than
make it worse.
Yeah.
I cite you Exhibit A, Moana.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know.
In fairness, the animation did have so much magic. Like, I even cried myself as an adult watching this. So I don't know if they're going to be able to pull off the magic with a live action version, but I hope they do. And I do hope they don't use AI. Like you mentioned.
Yeah, I hope they also don't rely. It's like when we were talking about Moana, it's like half the thing is still a cartoon, so what's the point?
Yeah.
And that release date will get changed because that is clashing with the Beatles.
Oh.
That will get changed.
Are you excited for that one?
two very different audiences, I would have thought.
But they're
Tangled
they're,
and the
if
Beatles.
They, if Sam, what's his face? The director, Sam Mendes. Yes, if Sam Mendes wants to do what he originally said he'd do, which is release all four films at the same time, there won't be any room in cinemas for something like Tangled.
God, yeah, but would you go? I mean, you'd have to be even the most diehard Beatles fan. Would you go to four movies?
I will, yeah. This? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, like,
it's like kind of your job. Yeah, so
it's fun to give out about these things, but absolutely, everyone will want to see how this goes.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's watching it being made at the minute in real time. Yeah. So I think same people will go see it.
Yeah. And Princess Diary 3. And now, why isn't Julie Andrews coming back? She's just kind of retired from this kind of thing.
Well, she's 90, first of all. She's had a good stint. She's absolutely icon.
Neeson.
No, it hasn't stopped. But she said that she's actually just retired from on-screen acting.
Okay.
It's not her bag anymore. She doesn't want to do it. She wants to do her podcast and things that are a little bit low maintenance. But she did also say that she doesn't think she should be a part of the third film because it's Princess Mia's story, not hers. And if you didn't know, she played Queen Clarice Rinaldi, aka Anne Hathaway's granny, the Queen of Genovia. So yeah, sadly she will not be returning, but Anne Hathaway is going to come back as Mia Thermopolis. And we don't know when the film is going to come though, because she is pregnant. She's going to pop any minute now. So probably 2028, I would guess.
Or the same week as Tangled and the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
Just have a bit of a cue there.
Yeah.
Katrina Balfe is cousin to Caoimhe. I'm sorry.
Is she?
To the listeners, that means nothing. This is just total internal gossip here.
Okay. Oh my God, I love that. Woo, yeah. Congrats. Can we get her autograph? Can she come in and talk to us?
Yeah. I don't know. Congratulations for somebody being your cousin. I don't want to take away from Caoimhe, but like, it's not really her achievement.
No. Would you not be proud of your cousin, you know, doing this Hollywood movie?
Oh, I'm sure she's very proud of her. Yeah. But did you say want to get Katrina Balfe in or Caoimhe in? Because Caoimhe's just outside, but Katrina Balfe probably lives in Hollywood.
We love Caoimhe, but yeah, Katrina Balfe. Yeah,
sorry, Caoimhe. Tough. But, you know, we do have to take a break. More movies and booze, and we give away some money after this. Tell us about the red wine.
With some baby wine.
Yeah, some baby red wine, yes.
Baby red wine.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next wine we are trying is red, and it is from northern Italy, from the Piedmont region, and it is the same grape that goes into Barolo, which is Nebbiolo. And I feel like probably one of the hardest countries and regions to understand is Italy, because unlike France and a lot of, I suppose, the New World, where you're looking at grapes that are really familiar, you know, Chardonnay, Sauvignon, Cabernet, Shiraz. When you look at Italian wines, there are over 1,000 indigenous grapes. So you could look at a label and you wouldn't be able to decipher what is the region, what is the grape, what is the jargon, what am I looking for? So this one, I think, is a great one because Barolo is probably one of Italy's most famous exports. Alongside Brunello. And the grape in Barolo is Nebbiolo. And Barolo comes, I would always say, in the aspirational end of the wine list. It's just a wine that you're looking at €50 if you're lucky, kind of a job for, I suppose, a good quality Barolo. So where do you start and what do you do? So Piedmont is very close to the French border, just on the far side of the Alps. And what they have there are a few grapes. So you've got Barbera, you've got Dolcetto, and then you've got Nebbiolo. And Barolo, like Chablis, is a little place. So if you want to call your wine Barolo, the grapes have to come from the Barolo region.
Okay.
And they have to be 100%, exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And they have to be 100% Nebbiolo. But you can also, so a bit like Chablis, you can grow Nebbiolo outside of that in the Lange region, which is the greater one. So to go back to your analogy, say Dublin is the Lange region and Rathmines is Barolo. Okay.
Right.
So the key Barolo is from that key original area. And then there's a wider area, but you can also use it for Lange Nebbiolo. But what's amazing about this one, this producer here is Tredaberry. They are based in the heartland.
I'm just thinking people have just tuned in going, they make wine in Rathmines?
They make really good wine, Barolo. this producer is from the heartland of Barolo. So a lot of grapes that are in this would have a destiny for Barolo. But they mightn't be mature enough yet. The roots mightn't have gone down deep enough yet. You know, it mightn't taste exactly what they want for their iconic Barolo style. So they'll declassify it, is the phrase that they would use, to put it into the Lange Nebbiolo. So what you're getting a lot of the times, and it depends on the producer you go for, but most of the times I think they take their wine really, really seriously in Piedmont because the calibre is so big and the potential is so big. It's like building in Rathmines a shack.
You know, why would you build a shack when you get more if you just do the right job? And so they do a really, really good job. So I would still say for an everyday wine, it's still the same price as the Petit Chablis. It's still up there. But it's just an amazing example of having the potential to try what is one of Italy's most iconic wines at literally 50% less. And the thing with Barolo is that Barolo, to be even released onto the market legally, has to be 4 years old. So what you'd be looking at, this is 2026, the youngest Barolo you're going to find on the market is 2022.
Okay.
And then, so what are you paying for? So say someone grew, imagine you did all your work now for News Talk and then you got paid for it in 4 years. They were holding back the good stuff. Yes. You know what I mean? It's all okay. Well, you'll get paid for it.
I can tell you a story.
So basically what happens is, like with Rioja Reservas and things like that, a lot of the laws are like you can't release it until it's in its optimum drinking window. So Barolo was released when it's going to be at least drinkable. The tannins will have come down a little bit. Whereas with the Langhe Nebbiolo, they're just released. So it allows you to try a wine without having paid for somebody to age it, because there's a value in that they've sat on that in those big old barrels. So I think that's a really good thing about it, is that you're able to drink wines in youth without having to have paid for somebody to have aged it. And Tredaberry, this particular producer, and I've put them up on my Instagram at Michelle Oller Wine in case anyone wants to have a look at it. Tredaberry started in under 20 years ago as the new wave of what is the best potential for a Barolo. Because years ago, Barolo, the minimum was 4 years. It used to be 6 to 8 years. And so you'd get out these big, dry, tarring wines and your gums would be stuck to your teeth and your lips. And it was really difficult to even drink and enjoy them. And so they changed the rules around it a little bit. But even if you change the rules, some people are still stuck in their ways. So they're still kind of honing back to this olden style. Whereas Tredaberry have done this amazing job of creating this wine. Have you tasted it?
Yeah, no, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
It's gorgeous. It is dry, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's definitely. And the thing with the dry one, so Nebbiolo is perfect for people who like maybe a Pinot Noir, okay? Because although the wine is light in colour, if you were to look at that, I bet, does anyone have a watch on? Chris has a watch. I bet if you hold that at a 45 degree angle, you can read the time through it. It's light enough, like it's like a Valpolicella or a Pinot Noir. And it can be really deceptive because you might look at that and think, oh, I don't like those thin wines. But actually, the intensity of a Nebbiolo is huge, and the vibrancy and the tannins in it, they're perfect for food. If you're going to have a little bit of food with this, you'd be thinking of having something like pork, you know, what all, or lamb or duck, something with loads of fat, because that acidity will cut through it. The tannins are gorgeous with it. And this particular area, Piedmont, is kind of like wild boar and white truffles and all that. Ooh, amazing. Yeah. So it's like the gas.
A little bit of wild boar.
Love wild boar. Yeah. So delicious. So look, I would say if you want to try Italian wines, and I feel like Italian wines are really intimidating unless you've either been on holiday to the region and you've got a bit of a grasp for it, because otherwise you kind of go, I'll have the Montepulciano, or I'll have something from Puglia, or I'll have a Valpolicella, you know, things that are really familiar. And you look at this label and you're like, I don't know what those words mean, so I'm just going to avoid it. But there's so much joy, especially if you're a food lover, if you're cooking at home, if you tend to be at home cooking nice food rather than out at the weekend, having a wine like this is perfect. And if you are looking for something a little bit different, there are a few other baby wines from Italy. So if you like Brunello.
But we don't have time to talk about them. Okay. I'm sorry, because we've only got 4 minutes left.
Sorry.
We need to get to the second film.
Next time.
Sorry. Okay, next time. That'll be a part two for that. Well, you never kept talking before, really. You're breathing through your ears there. Our next film is called Anne's Sons. Here's a clip.
I'm dying. I want you to come to me.
I haven't been here for like 20 years. I didn't think I'd ever come back.
Do we hug? I know you're familiar with the story of Andy's conception.
Oh, you mean the one about you having an affair and destroying Mum's life and taking the baby in afterwards?
All of which is true, except the story itself.
Ew.
Yeah.
Right. So that little clip kind of set it up. Like his children hate him because he had an affair and his marriage split up.
Yeah. Adored by readers, hated by his family. And he's knocking about this mansion in Oxfordshire. He's a bit of a Howard Hughes type, complete shut-in, hasn't left the house for 20 years. His teenage son lives with him, played by Noah Jupe. He is the product of an extramarital affair that actually destroyed the family. Imelda Staunton's Isabel left him. His older sons hate him. But as I say, he thinks Casey's, you know, at death's door. So he rounds up, you know, the older sons to tell them something. So he calls them into his office and he tells them something that's George Mackay as Jamie, his son, who's an artist, and then Johnny Flynn as Richard, who's a screenwriter and a recovering alcoholic. And the thing that he has to tell them concerns the younger son and the younger son's origins. I will not tell you what he says, even though it's in the first half an hour, but okay. I will say that it's a sci-fi twist. It is a bit of a sci-fi twist.
So we're into kind of about time territory.
We are, but that's the thing. Like, I was watching this thinking, if you're going to make a film where Bill Nighy calls his son into his office, Bill Nighy being a literary expert,
yeah,
and he calls his son into his office to tell him this big family secret, you need to top about time. You need to go better than that.
Yeah.
And there is a huge twist here, and it is quite absurd, but it has nothing to do with time travel. Somehow it's weirder. And I applaud David Gilbert, the writer, for coming up with this, and Sarah Polley for adapting it. With Pablo Tirano, who's an Argentine filmmaker making his English language debut here. But I think that the actors don't really know what to do with this thing because it's huge. It had me scratching my head. And you have this, there's a sense of strain here with the performers that they start right after that twist is revealed. They start making so much noise. They're just running around the place screaming and crying and tearing shreds out of each other. It's a point where I was like, this thing should be on a stage. One, because it's mostly in a single setting, but two, because of the volume of the performance, basically. Mm. But I think there's a sense that they're all trying to distract us, basically, from this thing that's getting in the way of a good drama. Because there's enough here for a straightforward drama. It's a film about parental guilt, about, you know, inheriting, you know, your parents' misery, about dads, like, why do you want to become a parent in the first place? What do you want your kids to be? Do you want them to be exactly like you, or do you want them to go, you know, a different way entirely? There's some really interesting stuff there, emotionally intelligent stuff for the actors to sink their teeth into. But most of their performance goes into distracting us from the silliness. So I think Bill Nighy's great here. Johnny Flynn is superb. Imelda Staunton is just at our best. But it's just a film where the ideas are just getting in the way, I think.
Did it have any of the sweetness of About Time?
No, absolutely not. No, there's a bit of sentimentality there. But About Time, I'll finish with this, is a film I watch once a year just to make, just for those, you know, warm and fuzzies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know somebody.
I won't be watching this once a year.
I know somebody who rang me coming out of the studio. I said, I'm just saying, I couldn't get the name of the film. I was crying so much. That's our lot for today. Thanks to Shannon Keenan, Chris Wasser and Michelle Lawler.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.